Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour. Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
And here he is. Toby, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Philip. Very well.
Very well. A little bird tells me it was your birthday yesterday.
Oh, wow. How'd that come through?
And another little bird. I don't know how you arrange this, but as a man who knows a gear shift sequence, putting things in order, that tomorrow is your daughter's birthday as well.
It is indeed.
Hey!
It is. So, and it was the cat's birthday the other day too. So.
Happy birthday, Chloe, and happy birthday, Toby.
Thank you.
Good on you, mate.
Thank you.
All right. Now, what's been happening? You've been to the LA Motor Show.
I have, LA Motor Show. So there's been a bit of a battle in recent years between the LA and Detroit motor shows, obviously Detroit being the home of the automotive industry in America. But
no one makes cars in LA anyway.
No, but plenty of people buy them in LA. It's car central, obviously, in LA. So it's an apt place for a motor show, obviously. It's a lot goes on there in terms of motoring, and they, as I said, they love their cars. But yeah, LA show this week, and it was a terrific show. It was it actually had quite a bit of stuff going on. So I find these days some of the motor shows are a little bit flat because they tend to release a lot of the information ahead of time. So you see the stuff beforehand, and
so there's nothing really
when they
new
pull
there.
The covers off, you say, oh yeah, whatever. But this year there were some quite good ones. So two of the most iconic cars in the world, so the Porsche 911 and the Jeep Wrangler, both had either a new version, an all new version in the form of the Porsche 911. Or a variant of, in the form of the Jeep Gladiator, which is the Ute version of the Wrangler. So the classic Jeep with the, you know, the sort of retro styling and everything, but a four-door Ute that's all designed to take on things like Toyota Hilux, Ford Ranger, and so on. So, big news there. And another one, the Mazda 3. So an all-new Mazda 3, which only the fourth generation one of those. And that is in the country sort of mid-next year, June, July next year. So that's also another big one for Mazda, their top-selling car.
It is their top-selling car, isn't it?
The absolutely.
The 3 or the 2?
The 3, yeah. So the 3 has actually been coming off a bit in sales as SUVs rise. But it is still the top-selling Mazda, and look, they still plan to sell plenty of them. It's one of the top-selling cars in the country. It's these days outsold by the Toyota Corolla and the Toyota Hilux and the Ford Ranger. But it's certainly still one of the more popular cars in the country. And as Mazda keeps pointing out, it is the top-selling car to private buyers. The significance there being, once you take out the fleet buyers, who typically get pretty big discounts, and they'll go and, you know, buy potentially hundreds at a time. Once you pull all those out of the mix, then the Mazda 3 is the top-selling car.
Well, that's what you want in a way, isn't it?
Because absolutely.
Private buyers are actually paying real money for them, whereas a 100%. Lot of fleet buyers are not paying.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fleet market can skew the market, which then has potential impacts in the used car market. So what you find is when those cars hit the market, particularly rental cars, so if you put, you know, if a Hertz or Budget or whatever buys a couple of thousand of one make, you know, a year or two later when they go to sell those cars, suddenly you've got an extra few thousand of those cars hitting the market. And the only way to sell them really is to discount them to try and make them appealing. So it's sort of, you're going against the natural demand, whereas if you're just selling to private buyers, that is pure natural demand. So it's,
interesting. Okay. Korean car maker SsangYong is relaunching in Australia.
They are, yeah.
Tell me about this. I don't know much about these cars. Are they any good?
Look, like a lot of those cars, so a lot of the Chinese brands, they are a big surprise on what a lot of people think. So a lot of people think they're going to get into them and they'll instantly look and feel like they're not put together properly. These ones absolutely, you can see they've taken a massive step change in terms of how they've screwed the things together, the interior presentation, the general maturity of the car. That said, there are still some issues here and there with some of the things they've tackled. But look, SsangYong in Australia, it's had a bit of a checkered history. So it's been on sale since the 2000s, since the 90s. It's been on and off a little bit. It was recently imported by a company called Ateco, which also looks after Maserati, or the same people there look after. They do it under a different mob called European Imports, I think it is. But So it's been done by an importer. It had been done by an importer. Now the factory's here for the first time. So they're pretty keen to make a go of it and, I guess, get the brand to stick, which it really has struggled to make big inroads in Australia. Mm. It's had little successes here and there. So they're coming out with three models. So they've got the Tivoli, which is a small SUV, the Rexton, which is a seven-seat SUV, and the Musso, which is one of the dual cab utes. So a big... or a decent range kicking in. But, you know, I touched on how they're sort of hit and miss with some things. So one of the things, look, value-wise, phenomenal value in terms of on paper, you look at the prices that they're charging and the features you get in them, and there's a lot more in them compared with, the say, the Japanese manufacturers that it's competing with. But and it also gets a seven-year warranty. And one of the cool things, so it matches what Kia claims is industry best warranty, which is the 7-year warranty, unlimited kilometre warranty you get with the Ssangyong, with the Kia. The difference with the Ssangyong is if you're buying one for commercial use, so if you're a taxi driver, a courier, an Uber driver, whatever it might be, you can, if you're buying a Kia, there's a clause in that 7-year warranty that says, with commercial use, there's a kilometre limit on how far you can drive it. But with the Ssangyong, there's not. So they're saying as many as you want. So I think if I was looking to buy a new taxi or something, I'd be into one of them in a heartbeat because you can all of a sudden do literally, you know, half a million kilometres. And, I mean, every car is going to have an issue in 500,000 Ks. So you just keep sending it back.
I like this. On the Ssangyong Rexton, which is their seven-seater, when you go around a corner, you put the indicator on.
Yeah.
Instead of going click, 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 it goes.
Well, it tweets like a bird. So you can choose. The guy was showing me. He said, oh, look at this. Which sound do you want for the indicators? And I thought, really? You can choose different sounds? So, something like a Jaguar or a Land Rover have quite a distinctive sound with their indicator clickers. And you'll be surprised how much effort a car maker puts into a tiny thing like that. But, yeah, this one, they've said, oh, we'll have a bit of fun with it. So you can go in there and you get this tweeting bird, which just sounds wrong. You're suddenly looking around going, where's that thing? And I can't imagine. I think it'll be a cool little trick to show your friends. I'm not sure many people will be saying, yeah, I'll keep that one forever.
Because the irritant value might be quite high.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
And you can switch it off, though, can you?
Yeah, you just go back to the normal clicker. And then you can adjust the volume of the normal clicker. So it's...
The 911, the Porsche 911, as you say, an iconic sports car, they've got a new model out, but you say probably most people mightn't be able to pick it.
Yeah, look, the average... When a new 911 comes out... you know what it's going to look like. Like they've looked like that for decades.
They've always looked like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they have. So it's a real. In one ways, I guess it's easy for designers because they say, "Well, we know it's roughly going to look like that. It's going to have the big haunches over the rear wheels and the circular, or the oval shaped headlights, all that sort of stuff." But at the same time, you've got to make it new enough so that the fans, the enthusiasts who are drawn to those sorts of cars, will see value in it and obviously want to spend money on a new one. So look, there are differences. The lower grille, for example, at the front is a lot broader. The bonnet is squarer. So in terms of it used to really curve around quite a bit. Now it's a lot squarer, a lot wider. So they've actually widened it 45 millimetres at the front. And obviously they then have to widen the rear as well so that it all looks in proportion. And it's also the first one that is almost certain to have a hybrid system in it. So they're not launching with a hybrid, so it will be purely six-cylinder engines to start with, six-cylinder twin-turbo engines. But it will, at some stage in its life, we're expecting probably in about 4 years, it'll get a hybrid system. So they've engineered an area where they can fit an electric motor and obviously batteries so that they can make it run on petrol and electricity, all part of this, the push towards lowering emissions and meeting those future emission standards.
All right, and before we get to some calls, vehicle sales, car sales have continued to slide. The market's down 7.5% in November. Well, you know, house prices are down. And there's a real link, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely there's a link. And the car makers are noticing it big time. The boss of Mazda the other day was saying that's one of the key drivers for this lowering of vehicle sales, as is the tightening on credit. We've seen, obviously, financial institutions come under pressure from, to make it, to not just give away finance to anyone willy-nilly. So there's those. But, yeah, if you look at the link between sales in, so the two markets that have been hit pretty hard by the housing downturn, New South Wales and Victoria, or I guess we should say Melbourne and Sydney, They typically account for about 60% of vehicle sales. So they're two obviously very big car markets, but they're actually accounting for 79% of the decline in vehicle sales over the last few months. So a huge part of that drop is coming out of those two markets. And yeah, a lot of it's attributable to house sales. Mm.
Luxury cars are well down too.
Well, luxury struggling big time, yeah. I mean, this all comes, if you think
Merc,
about
Audi,
it.
Audi, Porsche, Ferrari.
Yeah, Merc down 34%, Audi down 24%, Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini also down, Rolls-Royce down 78%, now admittedly on tiny numbers. They only sell a handful each month. It's hurting. And look, if you look at a luxury car, no one needs a luxury car. It's a discretionary purchase. So the minute things start getting a little bit tight, that's one of the first things people tick off the list. They either say, I'll leave it a year or two till I buy that luxury car I'm going to reward myself with, or I'll just buy a mainstream car. I'll buy something.
I'll buy you.
Yeah, well, they do luxury ones of those now as well, Phil.
Speaking of which, the Utes remain the top 4,700 Hiluxes.
Yeah, 4,700 Hiluxes. Massive number of.
That's a lot of Utes, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. And it's, a fraction over one in six vehicle sales these days is a Ute. Most of them, the 4x4 dual cab ones, so the more expensive end of the market, which is where the growth really has been. Ford Ranger, 3,500, so that's also second best selling vehicle on the market. Utes just continue to go very strongly. So it's there's not a whole lot of slowing down in that market, which is
Poor old Holden. Well, poor old Holden. I mean, Holden continue to hurt.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
they're struggling, aren't they? They were down 36% in this month.
Down 36%. One thing we should remember, obviously, is November last year is when they built the last locally produced Holden. Yep. So they had that extra hit there of locally made cars. So that is out of the equation these days. But, yeah, look, they really are struggling. But, you know, some of the other big brands, I mean, Hyundai's down 10%, Mazda down almost 5%, Volkswagen down 12%. So, some of the big brands are certainly on the slide for various reasons. But, it's a tough market.
Yep. You talked to Holden boss Dave Butner, actually, didn't you, about the challenges that they face?
I did, yeah. He made the point of the Equinox. So this is their mid-sized SUV. It effectively replaces the Captiva, which was it was around for about 10 years, and it was fairly successful in terms of sales, maybe not as successful in terms of building brand image. But he said they did a little bit of investigating on how that new, relatively new nameplate has cut through, and it turns out it hasn't been brilliant. He said of the people considering a mid-size SUV, things like Honda CR-V, Toyota RAV4, Mazda CX-5, he said only about 5% of them have even heard of the Equinox. So they haven't put it on their shopping list, but whether they've heard of it, they've got to put it on their shopping list. So if you look at that and you say, well, each month roughly 15,000 mid-sized SUVs are sold in Australia. So you take the 5%, you're looking at about 750 buyers is the pool they can choose from. That's if they can convince every one of those that's heard of it to then go out and buy the car. And that's never going to happen. So they do have an enormous challenge on their hand. And a lot of new nameplates there. You know, they got the Arcadia, the seven-seat SUV, the bigger one than Equinox. They've got challenges. He acknowledges that. I guess it's a slow burn. They're never going to turn the brand around in a month or two. I mean, this is years trying to rebuild that brand.
Yeah. Hello, Deb.
Yes, hi. How are you, Philip?
I'm very well.
Look, I'm going for a test drive tomorrow. My car died, and I'm going for a test drive for a Nissan X-Trail. Mm-hmm. And it's got CVT transmission. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to my mechanic, and he said, no, don't get anything with CVT transmission because they're unreliable. It could break. It might be fine when you first get it, but it might break down in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know what your thoughts are on the CVT transmission are.
So CVTs, early CVTs in some ways were a bit like early turbochargers. They got a bit of a bad name for some of the issues they had. And Honda in particular throughout the 2000s, so with things like Jazz and HRV, the previous HRV, they had some decent problems with those failing, with some of the CVTs failing. Honda came out and acknowledged that, and they actually did they fixed some of them under warranty, and they also did, for ones that were older, they also did some fairly affordable and cheap replacements. So That said, the technology, as with turbo technology, has come a heck of a long way since then. So it's these days a lot more reliable. A lot more car companies use it. So you've got, you know, Toyota, for example, on a lot of their models, Corolla, RAV4, those sorts of things have got it. Audi has used it quite a bit in the past. Obviously, Nissan now. So there's a lot of brands using it. We don't hear of major issues with those sorts of transmissions failing. So, as I said, they've come a long way. So I would absolutely not be worried about it failing.
This is a 2011. It's going to be a second-hand car.
Yeah, right, okay. Okay, so that's a little bit different when, when you've got an older car. I still wouldn't be completely concerned with one of that era. If you told me it was an early 2000s car, I'd say, yeah, maybe. But I think the first ever CVT was the Nissan Micra back in about 91 or 2 or 3, something like that. But So that's how long they've been doing them. So they've learned a bit about them in that time. But as I said, I wouldn't be overly concerned about them. I mean, there's, you know, you look at any transmission, things can go wrong. You buy a manual gearbox, the clutches can burn out. You buy an automatic transmission, the torque converter can go. So there are things that can happen, and an older car generally is potentially going to have issues. So I'm not saying it won't fail, but I don't think the prospects of it failing are any worse than other technologies out there.
They said they can give me a 3-year warranty.
This is the dealer you're buying it off?
Yes.
Yeah, so be really wary of those warranties. They'll often lock you into fairly onerous service schedules. So they'll say you don't just have to do the normal service, you have to do all these extra things, and they can be pretty expensive. So I would ask for a list of what the service involves and how much those services will cost. Just go through the fine print of whatever that contract is relating to the 3-year warranty, because sometimes they're not worth the paper they're written on.
Okay, that's very good to know. Wonderful.
Thanks, Deb.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Good luck with it. I hope the purchase goes well. Archie, hello.
G'day. Philip, Toby, do you think GMH have made a bad mistake in calling that new Commodore the Commodore? It's obviously hasn't sold, and they've got 2 years' worth of cars, apparently, in the country. They can't move.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite 2 years. I know there's a lot of paddocks around with Commodores in them, but... they won't be sitting around for 2 years. They'll discount them if they have to. So they won't give them 2 birthdays. But look, in terms of whether they should have called it Commodore, look, I guess you could look back on it now and say that was a bad move. I wasn't completely offended with it. I can see why they would do it. They've invested, obviously, the best part of 30 years in developing that Commodore nameplate. Commodore, I guess, is known to a lot of people as a large family car. And the new one is, it hits that mark. What it doesn't do, it's not an Australian-made car, and that's where I think they've really maybe hurt it a little bit. But as I said, I wasn't completely offended. But, yeah, you look back on it and say, well, maybe they should have come out with a new nameplate for that one and given it a fresh start. But, I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of car, well, if Commodore eventually doesn't exist in 5, 6, 7 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, but because those sorts of cars, those large sedans, are all sort of dropping off the radar of a lot of private buyers.
Did they? Yes, I agree.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Archie. Richard, hello.
Hello, Bill. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
How are you doing? Bill, we've been traditionally Land Cruiser owners, Skyback owners for many years.
Hello, Richard. I hope he's... Oh.
Needs a new phone, I think, before a car.
Needs a new phone before... He was going to ask you about a Mercedes G3000 anyway. Let's talk to Frank instead. I'll put you back on hold there, Richard, just in case we can dig you back out of the telephone ether. Hello, Frank.
Toby. Yes. I've looked at these cars, and this an X-Trail, Toyota RAV4, Honda Tucson.
Yep.
Now, of those three, with a running cost, which one would be the right, which I on the right direction, like?
Well, running costs is a little bit about how long is a piece of string, because you've got to look at you're getting the diesel, the petrol, what the service intervals are, how many k's you're driving. So we won't be able to run through all of that in this time. With the RAV4, be aware that in the next couple of months is an all-new RAV4 coming into the market. So what you'll probably see is some pretty sharp run-out deals on that older car, particularly heading into the new year, assuming, it depends how they're going with run-out stock and so on, but I wouldn't be surprised, as I said, if they sharpen their pencils a bit. And also have a look at that new model, which comes out with a lot more features and so on. So have a look online, you'll see the pictures of it there. So in terms of the other stuff, your single biggest cost on owning a car, and in terms of the cost of the car, is resale value. So that's one thing you should absolutely consider as well. It's not so much using an extra $5 or $10 of fuel each week. It's what the thing's going to be worth in 3, 4, 5 years when you go to sell it. So that's another massive one there. And something like Toyota RAV4s, they tend to hold their value extremely well. That said, that market generally is pretty reliable for that too. But,
and this X-Trail and the Hyundai Tucson, what are they like?
They're good. So the X-Trail's strength is its size. It's a little bit bigger than the rest of the mid-sized SUVs. You can actually get a 7-seat version of it as well. So it's a very small third row of seats, but you can get that extra row of seats in the back there. In terms of picking between those ones, keep in mind the Nissan only has a 3-year warranty. They will sometimes do deals on a 5-year warranty, but their standard offer is a 3-year warranty, and same with the Toyota, whereas the Hyundai gets a 5-year warranty. So that's another thing to keep in mind as well, a little bit more peace of mind. So, the Hyundai's certainly decent value, good value in that front. But,
and the Tucson's a bit bigger, isn't it?
Not bigger than an X-Trail, I wouldn't have thought, no. So the Nissan tends to be one of the bigger ones in that market. But Tucson is a, they're all decent-sized vehicles these days. They've been stepping up in size over the last 10 or 15 years.
And, so I'll get a 5-year warranty with a high-end of Tucson then.
You will. And if you get the Kia, you'll get a 7-year warranty. So there's that to think about. But, yeah, I wouldn't just limit yourself to those ones either. I would also stick... And this might, you maybe don't want to expand the field, but I would stick a Subaru Forester and a Mazda CX-5 into the mix as well. They're two excellent cars too.
All right.
Thanks, Frank. Bye-bye. Barry, hello.
Hello. I'm making an inquiry on behalf of a friend. I don't drive myself. Mm. But in relation to a new car in Australia, whether it was manual or automatic, what type of car would probably be the cheapest you could buy in Mount Isa? I don't mean Mount Isa, but I mean in Australia.
So you mean cheapest brand new car?
But cheapest brand new car, either manual or automatic.
So it'll depend on the deals that are happening right now, but it's at the lower end of that market, that the so-called micro cars, you can typically get into one for about $13,000 if you buy a manual. And the manuals will usually be cheaper, something like a Mitsubishi Mirage, which is okay buying. It's nothing special. Suzuki Swift is great buying if you can stretch to it. And that probably won't be quite that cheap, but you should be able to get into one for within a grand or two of that, or something like a Toyota Yaris. So those three are both sort of fairly safe buying in that end of the market, and also fairly affordable buying. Kia Rio is another one, or a Kia Picanto actually is even cheaper again. So if you get a Kia Picanto, they're doing some pretty decent deals on them, and you get that 7-year warranty. So it's it's pretty good buying for one of those as well.
So what you say about $12,000-$13,000?
It'll really depend. So often they'll do a deal where they'll knock say $1,000 off one of these cars for a month or so, just to clear some stock. So not all of those, absolutely no, not all of those will go down to 12 grand. Some of them, so the Swift, for example, will be more than that. Some of them in that month you look at them might be more than that. So it's a matter of going on and just seeing what the absolute mega deals are for that month. And as I said, if they want to shift some cars, they'll knock $1,000 off them to do that. And that makes a huge difference at that end of the market. So, but they're all towards the lower end of that market.
About 13,000, Barry.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Is it a bit of... Everyone wants to buy things before Christmas. Are cars like that? I mean, I was talking to a bloke the other day who makes mattresses, right? I said, are mattresses like that? He said, no. No one buys them before Christmas. They wait till after Christmas.
Oh, right. Well, that happens.
Cars like that? Or?
It happens a little bit with the car market because everyone thinks, oh, wow, come January 1, I'm going to save thousands off the car. And look, in a lot of cases, they will. So the car industry, when you buy a car, it comes in with a compliance plate as well as a build plate. Now, the build plate is fairly obvious. That's when it rolled off the production line. It's the month and year that it rolled off the production line. The compliance plate is the time it came out of, well, it was cleared by Australian Customs. So they said, okay, you're fine to take that car now, off you go. If they're obviously around this time of year, the cars that are arriving into the country now were built, well, let's say the ones that are arriving in the next few weeks, they might not get out of customs until January, and they'll have a January compliance plate, but the build plate will be November, October, whenever it was, whenever the car was built. When it comes to selling that car, the car dealer is going to sell it as a, and he, they can legally do this, sell it as a 2019 model. Say, well, it's a compliance 2019, and they can legally do that. There's no issue with that. But when you go to trade that car in 3 or 4 years and say, okay, I'm trading it in now, they will value that car as a 2018 car. It's a way for them to make it look a year older, even though it's only a matter of weeks older. So yeah, keep in mind that as soon as January comes around, the car is theoretically considered 1 year older than it was the day before. So, from a resale perspective, that can make a pretty big difference. So it's worth keeping it in mind. But no, the rush, it tends to slow down a bit, in the direct lead up for Christmas and also between Christmas and New Year, you'll tend to slow down. But January, early January for private buyers is very strong. For those fleet buyers, most businesses, obviously a lot of people are on holidays. So the fleet buyers tend not to be too active in January, but that's where the car dealers tend to start targeting the private buyers and saying, okay, we'll do some campaigns aimed at them.
Yeah, my mattress man said the reason is because after Christmas, he said mattresses are typically something which, a couple would buy together, like one person wouldn't go in and just have it delivered. The couple would need to go and have a look at it together. So maybe it's a bit the same with cars for private buyers. That is,
Absolutely.
You want your partner to have a look at the car too.
Yeah. A lot of, a lot of family cars and a lot of in a family, it's absolutely not usually one person making the decision. It's, you'll get at least two people saying, well, hang on, that might not suit our needs and we need that one as well.
What do you reckon? What's the query, Luke?
Oh, good evening, fellas.
Hi.
Look, I'm just looking at buying a second-hand Volkswagen Passat station wagon. I just wanted to know, Toby, what you thought about those and whether they're notorious for any certain problems or anything.
Yeah, so, look, in terms of spaciousness, the way it drove, it was absolutely one of the best cars in that market. Still is the current Passat, an excellent vehicle with all that sort of stuff. Yeah. They are fairly fuel efficient in terms of their fuel consumption. So that's also pretty good. As I said, dynamics and so on, excellent in terms of the way they drive. Yeah. The one issue that Volkswagen's had with quite a few cars are the DSG transmissions, the twin clutch automatic transmissions, of which the Passat had them, still has them now. They fixed a lot of those issues and they're aware of the parts that were failing and have addressed most of those issues. And in any cars that are failing, they these days tend to be pretty good about trying to help out with solving the issue. But in all of those cars, even a brand new one, they're not as smooth in their initial take up. So the way the car, if you're sitting at a set of lights and you give it half throttle to go and take off, they're not always as smooth and consistent as a regular automatic transmission. So in some ways, you need to either adjust your driving style or accept the fact that it's not going to be quite as smooth. Just be aware that, as I said in the past, they have had some issues with those transmissions.
Yeah, because I did read that they changed something in 2011, possibly. Is that right?
I would have thought it would be a fraction after that. They had issues with... So some of the failures were clutch packs. There was also one of the big electronic components had some issues with it. There were a few issues, but as I said, they've fixed most of the reliability problems with it, to my knowledge. Yep. From a drivability perspective, not everyone is always sold on them.
Okay, and just personally, you think they are a pretty decent car?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in terms of an all-round package and a car that certainly drives very nicely, one of the better driving cars in that class, and there are some excellent cars in that class in terms of how they drive. And it's always surprising, I think, when people get into one of those cars. These days, so many people buy SUVs, and I'm driving so many SUVs because that's what so many people want. And suddenly you step into one of these cars that has a lower center of gravity, so it's... they often feel more agile around a corner. They're less susceptible to leaning around bends. So they sort of feel almost sports car like, some of them. And I'd put that in that category. That Passat is certainly a nice car.
Yeah, because I was tossing up. There's the 1.8 litre turbo, or there's the R36 as well.
The R36 is a rorty thing for sure.
give it a Give it a bit of stonk, Luke.
Look, the V6 engine was a great engine and certainly a heap of performance, and having that all-wheel drive obviously helps out. But if you're not absolutely sold on the performance, and the 132, the 1.8-litre engine was also a fine engine. So, yeah.
All right, thank you so much.
No worries, Luke. Thank you. Charlotte, hello.
Oh, hi. Well, my dream car is an electric Tesla, but unfortunately I don't have that sort of budget, nor for an iPace. So I've been looking and waiting for the Ioniq to come out, the fully electric one.
Yep.
And what I wanted to ask you, Toby, is this the first Hunter's electric car, as in affordable, accessible,
it's the so we should explain what the Ioniq is. There's the Hyundai, it's just gone on sale, this Hyundai Ioniq, yeah, and it's there's been a lot of debate about where this electric technology is going, and obviously hybrid has been seen as a stepping stone to full electric vehicles. Hyundai is actually offering three different versions of the Ioniq. So you've got a regular hybrid, which competes directly with the Toyota Prius, so it only ever runs on petrol. It's got an electric motor there that charges, or the battery charges off the regenerative brakes and so on. You've then got a plug-in hybrid version, which is similar sort of hybrid system, but you've also got a bigger bank of batteries, so you can drive 40-odd Ks on electric only, recharge it, but if you need to drive further, you can, you've got the petrol engine there to do that. Then there's the full electric one that you're talking about, which is, as it says on the box, it's a full electric car. So what I love about this car is they're leaving the choice in the hands of the average punter and saying, okay, everyone's arguing over which technology is right. Well, you take your pick. Here they all are. So they all step up in price, incidentally. So the cheapest one is the regular hybrid. The electric one starts at about 45 from memory. So in terms of, is this the punter's electric car? Yes and no. I mean, we've had Nissan Leaf on sale in Australia for similar sort of money. Actually, it was a little bit more list price, but they were doing discounts that were sharper than that. So Nissan Leaf, you could argue, was like that. And there's a new Nissan Leaf out next year. But at the moment, it is the most affordable electric car on the market, and I've driven it, and it's a good car. Probably the letdown for me on that car was not performance or anything like that. It drives pretty well; it's got decent performance, but I felt the interior was a little bit plasticky. So it was a little bit cheaper on the interior. You can see where they've tried to save some money. They're throwing this high-tech drivetrain at it, and they've said, oh, we'll save some money on all this other stuff inside. So it's that's a minor disappointment, but I love what they've done with the car.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte. Hello, Richard.
Again, thank you for your persistence.
That's
right. After many years of Land Cruiser trade-back ownership, I'm finding that for a lot of our applications, we don't get the carrying capacity, and we're wondering just whether the Mercedes G3000 is going to be worth its value or what they want for it. What are your thoughts on that vehicle?
So you're talking about the G-Wagon, the boxy one?
No, the stubborn cab chassis.
Oh, right, okay. Look, to answer your question, I'm not 100% sure in terms of what it'll be. You're talking about what sort of resale and so on it'll get later on.
What sort of value do you think they are? Are they going to be worth the extra $40,000?
It's a lot of money. And one area that that Land Cruisers and 70 Series Land Cruisers and 200 Series Land Cruisers do a phenomenal job is how easy they are to sell at the end of it, and how much money you get for them. And now, admittedly, if you're using them commercially or you're wearing them into the ground, obviously that's going to depreciate them a bit more. But I would be stunned if they held their value anything like that. Just
I'm not
because...
so worried about that, Toby. I'm more worried about, the load carrying capacity is nearly double of a cab chassis Land Cruiser. And for one of our applications, we need that actual extra carrying capacity. I'm just wondering, what's your thoughts would be, whether that be as good a vehicle in the long term? Because take a lot of feeding a Land Cruiser.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I think from a pure engineering perspective and getting the job done, I haven't driven one of those cars, but everything I've seen with everything else Mercedes has done in terms of the commercial side of the business, the vans and the utes and so on they do, they tend to go the distance pretty well, so they do a reasonable job with that. As I said, I haven't got experience with that one specifically. So I'd be surprised if it didn't go the distance and do what you're expecting it to do if you work it pretty hard, which it sounds like you're going to. But yeah, 40 grand's a lot of money. I'd almost be tempted to go two Land Cruisers, I reckon, and get an extra driver. But I know that's not practical for what it sounds like you're trying to achieve.
Beside on campers, it makes it a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, if you're putting all that stuff in there.
It's very hard to get under the gross weight with a slide on camper, but you can with a Mercedes. And I'm just thinking whether it's worthwhile for my retirement vehicle, whether it's worthwhile actually spending extra money.
Yeah. Look, to be honest, I can't answer it because I just haven't driven. I'm not that au fait with those sorts of with that particular model, and whether it's 100% going to do the job you want. But
it's a lot of money, as you say.
Oh, it's a lot of money. Yeah, 40 grand extra. I mean, Land Cruisers themselves aren't cheap. So it's the minute you're saying spend another 40 grand on one of those. That said, there are a lot of people in that sort of market that are trying to lift and tow heavy things, and which is where we're seeing the American trucks, the Chevy Silverados and Rams and so on, starting to pick up some of the market as well, because people are wanting to create mini motorhomes almost, and they end up being pretty heavy, and you've got to have a vehicle that can carry it. So
yeah. All right, Shelley, hello.
Hello. Hi Toby.
Hi.
Hey, I was just wanting to get your advice on a Subaru Forester 2019 model that comes with a 3-year warranty versus the 2018 model but offering 5 years at the moment. What would you kind of recommend?
I would recommend the 2019, the new model. The step, it was a massive step up from that from the previous Forester to the new one. The new one's been on sale roughly 4 months, something like that.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a much nicer car. So it's certainly quieter, better in terms of how it rides and handles. The engine is only a minor update of that engine that's already in there, but the rest of the car is a big step up. In terms of the warranty, keep in mind, and this is something the ACCC has been pushing very hard with car makers, saying forget what your warranty says on the box in terms of how many years it is. It needs to last a reasonable amount of time for how much you pay for the device, or whatever it is you're buying. So the short story is, if something like an engine gives up at 4 years, and it's very unlikely to happen, but if an engine ever blows up at 4 years and it's a $10,000 or $15,000 fix, provided you had the car serviced, you haven't mistreated it, you're almost certainly going to get back up there from the ACCC saying, well, hang on a minute, that's a major item that is absolutely expected to last longer than 4 years in a car. So you've got that consumer guarantee behind you, Australian consumer law behind you, that in many cases will go above what the 3-year warranty says. So with something like a Subaru, they've got an excellent reputation anyway for longevity and reliability. And you've got that Australian consumer law back up there. So I would 100% go the 2019 model.
Oh, okay, that's kind of where my gut was, so that's good. And what about, what model would you suggest? I was looking at like the premium, the iPremium.
Yeah, so I think it's the iPremium gets the more advanced auto braking system with it. It also gets the pretty tricky facial recognition, which is, so it's actually got a camera staring back at you. It's in the sort of center console on top of the dash. You can't actually, it's pretty well hidden inside the cowling, but it points back at you and it recognizes you or anyone else who gets in the car. So you've got to program it to your face like you do with a new smartphone or something, and it'll then adjust various features in the car. So instead of having to pick your favourite radio station, ABC of course, or having to adjust your seats and your mirrors, you basically sit in the car. The minute it spots your face, it will then adjust all those things for you. So that's pretty cool tech with it. Yeah, and it's that tech is also used for it monitors your eye movements and so on for drowsiness, and which is good and bad. We had one. We tested one at when I was doing Wheels Car of the Year testing, and we were on a proving ground, and I thought, I'm going to test this thing and see if I can pretend to be drowsy, and it starts beeping at you and telling you to wake up. And I was actually simulating looking around at the kids as you're driving, so you sort of pretend you're telling the kids off in the back seat, and yeah, even with that, it starts getting angry at you as well. So it's a car that's looking out for you.
Yeah, all right. But can you deactivate that if, you know, if you are looking
at it? Look, it won't go... I don't think you can from memory. I think it's always looking at you, but... it doesn't. I was trying to provoke it. I was sitting there trying to make it go off. So it certainly did that. But so I don't think it'll go off constantly. I think it'll be you know, there'll be times when maybe you're doing something you shouldn't be, and it'll tell you not to.
As long as it doesn't make any judgment, Shelley. Like you know, like you need a haircut.
Oh, I hope it's not too critical.
Indeed.
Okay, well, that's really helpful. I really appreciate you.
Thanks.
Your time.
Thanks Shelley. So much. Bye-bye, Shelley. 1-300-800-222. Alan's got a good question. G'day, Al.
Yeah, my father, who's gone to join the great parking lot in the sky, would never buy a new car. He said, you know, you lose far too much value the moment you drive it out of the dealership and within the first year,
mm-hmm.
and he tended to buy demos and cars with low mileages. So I'm wondering, as a general strategy, a demo is good value, or alternatively, I understand Mazda is about to bring out a whole new version of the Mazda 3. Is it a good strategy to buy the car that's about a brand new car that's about to be superseded?
Yeah.
Or if you're trying to get a good value in low mileage cars, I'm wondering cars that are slightly more luxury, you know, like 40, 50, 60,000, do people who buy those cars tend to turn them over more often than cars over under 30,000?
I'm not aware of any major difference in how long people hold on to vehicles depending on the price. So I think, you know, there are some people who say, I'll buy a car and keep it for 10 years or drive it into the ground, and others who say every 3 years I'll buy a new car. So in terms of whether to buy new or near new or demos and so on, the car dealers are very much aware of, or, you know, for them it's supply and demand. They will... In terms of the discount they'll offer on a demo, they'll only offer the discount they think they need to shift the car. So they're not going to say, all right, it's a demo, suddenly we knock $10,000 off it. They'll do exactly what they need to shift that car. At the very top end of the market, so your luxury cars where people often choose the colour of the stitching and the trim, the wooden trim they want around, and they go to every last detail of picking all that stuff. When you get into those sorts of cars, you can get some fairly impressive discounts if the car is sitting on the lot and the dealer's got it ready to go, because people are choosy with those cars. If they say to you, right, you can have that one there with the cream interior and the gold exterior, that's all yours now, and we'll give you a 20 grand discount on it. So that you can get some decent discounts on those. With something like a white Toyota Corolla, they probably sell, I don't know, 1,000 of them a month. So it's not an issue. If you don't want it, the next bloke who comes in will buy it. So, So it does depend quite significantly on the car. And as I said, the dealers are going to get exactly what they can for it, as much as they can for that car. But they'll also acknowledge the fact that a demo's got some Ks on it and so on. Keep in mind with a demo, if the demo is registered, so if it's not running on trade plates, if it's got proper number plates on it, then the warranty started when those number plates went on the car. So if they've been on there for 3 or 4 months, you've lost 3 or 4 months worth of warranty. So that's another thing to keep in mind. But the biggest thing with a new car, you know you're the only one who's driven it. You know you can pick everything you want, so you can pick the right colour. You don't have to compromise in any way. And, yeah, it's just for a lot of people, that's the peace of mind they want. They want to be able to pick exactly what they want. But you're dead right. I mean, in terms of the depreciation, It's usually something like 20 or 30% in the first year, and that's a big hit. And, you know, the people who are prepared to make some compromises will say, well, I'll go and buy one secondhand or buy a demo. But, you know, they're not always... There are compromises in doing that, I guess is what I'm saying.
And the model which is about to be superseded...
Yeah, that would depend a bit on how big the update is. So a car typically has a life of 6 or 7 years. So when they bring out an all-new model, like that Mazda 3 you're talking about, so that car will be around about 6 years. Throughout that life, they will do at least one major midlife update. Now, they don't change things like doors and glass and roof, but they will change bumpers and headlights and the easier stuff to change that gives it quite a decent look. So it would depend on if it's a major model change, an all-new model, which, as I said, this Mazda 3 is, or whether it's a facelift or a minor update, as to whether you'd then say, is it worth the step up? And it would also depend, I guess, how big a change they're making under the skin as well. So is it carryover engines? Is it all that sort of stuff? But what you tend to find is towards the... Well, when a new model comes out, it's the more expensive variants of that version that are popular early on. So you get the early adopters saying, I've got to get that new one. Towards the end of the car's life, it tends to be the cheaper versions that sell better. So So when the new model comes out, you might find you're naturally paying a fair bit more because it's the more expensive, the better equipped ones that are going to be coming into the market more often.
All right, thanks a lot.
Good on you, Al. Thank you. 1-300-800-222. Serena, hello.
Good evening. I was wondering if someone can enlighten me about the Fiat 500 Abarth, because this afternoon I was driving from Sydney north, and when I got onto the F3, I don't know if you're familiar with the road, and it goes from 80 to 110, it's going uphill, and suddenly I've got a Alfa Romeo 147. This thing flew past me, white, with red-coloured mirrors on the side and red and green stripe, and I could not catch it.
Yeah.
I was extremely crestfallen.
It was an Italian race on the freeway, by the sounds of it.
Fiat versus
and
Alfa.
When I finally caught up with it, just for a second, it was an Abarth.
Yeah. So
and
Abarth
is... propelled with these things.
Yeah, so Abarth is the sporty version or the sporty sub-brand of Fiat. And I don't actually think it has a Fiat badge on it, but...
Yes, it does.
Oh, may well do, but it's got...
Fiat 500, and then it's got Abarth on the side.
Yeah, so the Abarth... So when they actually refer to the car, they don't actually refer to it as a Fiat Abarth. They just call it an Abarth. Yeah.
How
and
much are they?
Oh, they start at, so the Fiat 500s usually start at sort of mid-20s, something like that. They were down to about 20 at one stage.
I mean, I love them. You know, if I didn't have an Alfa Romeo, I'd go and buy one.
Yeah, so the Abarth is a little bit more, so you're looking at high 20s to get into one of those.
Oh, is that
and a... then some of them will go up to about $40,000. And they actually did, a few years ago, they did a Ferrari version and a Maserati version. So they had the little badges on them. Now, they had nothing. They didn't have Ferrari engines or anything like that. They were effectively a marketing thing.
Uh-huh.
Look, those cars, they're not super powerful, but they're quite light, and they're 1.4-litre turbos. So it was a...
Oh, 1.4. Oh,
yeah,
I see.
It's only 1.4.
Yeah. But, no one could catch it.
Little hot hatch,
Serena. You're not gonna sit with that, are you?
Yeah. I'm going to get one.
I know. Good luck. Bye bye. Dear, it's look how time flies. Toby, you know your Kings of the Road book.
Kings of the Road, yes.
Yes. 50 cars that drove Australia. We've actually we've got some more copies of this. We're going to give some away to winners of the Mighty Challenge over the next few nights.
Sounds grand.
Kings of the Road. This is 50 cars that drove Australia. This has got all the cars in it that right from the very first Holden, the AHD.
Yeah,
what was it?
48215.
The 48215.
Yeah. So
everyone thinks it was the FJ, but it wasn't. Was it?
No. So it was that. The cars that we cover off were the, so this was...
How'd you get it down to 50?
Well, that was a struggle in itself. We actually started with about 130, 140.
Yeah.
And trying to drag those down to 50 was quite a challenge in itself, because there are so many cars that have helped shape Australian car culture. And you start going through them and looking at all the different models that are out there, Tiranas and Commodores and Falcons and Land Cruisers and so on. And then you've got some quite quirky ones into the mix, things like, Bulwar Nagari, the little sports car, the locally made sports car. And Elfins, Gogamobiles, the little Gogamobiles that were done by Bill Buckle in Sydney. So
I've forgotten about the Gogamobile.
The little dart. He designed it himself. He decided that he wanted to make one based off the car that was out of Germany, so using the underpinnings of that, but come up with something different. And that car's gone on to be iconic worldwide. So there's collectors who try and get them around the world.
Have you got
so
the Datsun 180B in there?
That was one of the ones on the 130 list that didn't quite make it to the 50 list. But the Datsun 180B was talked about. So we certainly talked about that.
The EH Holden's got to be in there.
Yeah, EH Holden's in there. There's plenty of Holdens in there.
Yeah.
But as I said, they're not all Australian-made cars. They're cars that have been, either famous, well-known, loved in some way. So, everything from Leyland P76, which was quite... ended up being a little bit controversial. It won Wheels Car of the Year, but it also got a little bit crucified for its reliability or lack thereof. Obviously Land Cruisers that have helped us explore the country. Nissan Patrol, the first car to cross the Simpson Desert,
and the Ford Territory, which is a terrific car.
Well, Ford Territory was the only car made, the only SUV proper SUV made in Australia. So it was. So yeah, I mean, look, that went the second that thing came out, it went to the top of the sales charts for SUVs. So anyway, it was a very popular car.
If you're thinking of a Christmas present, this is me talking. Kings of the Road is pretty good fun for Toby Hagen. Kings of the Road, it's called. It's around. Actually, speaking of books, there's another one out that that is by a mate of yours about the London and Sydney Marathon.
John Smales, yeah. So, well, it's the 50th anniversary of the London to Sydney Marathon as we speak, actually. So it kicked off, obviously, 50 years ago in London, made its way down through Pakistan, India, and so on, and to Perth and across Australia. So a massive, more than 16,000 kilometres of racing. And some people still think was the ultimate marathon, the ultimate test of a car and the people who were driving them. But a lot of controversy surrounding it and a lot of cool stories, which John's gone into a huge amount of detail on in terms of trying to really get into the nitty-gritty of what happened and some of the controversy around the Citroen that was leading until the final day and was involved in a crash with a local couple of local guys in the Mini. He actually tracked down one of the drivers of the Mini and had a chat to him. So, yeah, it's... good.
Look, good fun. All right. Toby, terrific. Now, are we going to see you before Christmas? Maybe not.
I actually think I'm heading out back again before Christmas. Okay. So maybe
if
not.
If we don't, have a happy Christmas to you and your family. Thanks for all the chats during the year, and we'll look forward to catching up again next year.
Love to. Good. Thanks, Philip.
Thanks, Toby.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.